11.
Robinson versus the City of West Allis. And we will hear from Philip J. Ramphan, who is counsel for Mr. Robinson.
Thank you very much, Your Honors. My name is Philip J. Ramphan. Seated to my right is Patrick Callahan of our law firm, who has assisted in the presentation of the briefs. As the court well knows, this is a review of summary judgment decision by the Court of Appeals. It is our position in this case that all of the context of the arguments must be taken in the realm of summary judgment methodology. Important is the fact that the Court of Appeals decision has removed a fundamental right of an injured person, a plaintiff in a civil case, from an ability to have a jury of his peers to determine issues and questions of law and of fact. The court does have some authority to resolve matters on summary judgment, but it is very limited and qualified, and in fact, in this case, it did occur on some of the issues which were originally raised. We believe the Court of Appeals made an erroneous ruling in two separate ways. The first is that it dismissed the excessive force case based on the fact that the plaintiffs did not produce an expert witness of any kind to state that there was, in fact, excessive force. Secondly, the court dismissed the deliberate indifference to the right of Mr. Robinson for medical treatment because they indicated there was no excessive force and there was no serious injury. We believe that these two factors are contrary to the state of Wisconsin law at this time. I would like to address the question of expert testimony to begin with. There are certain areas of the law in the state of Wisconsin which do in fact require an expert to testify. These are required only when the issues and questions that are raised are outside the ability of a layperson to understand what the issues are. The case cited by the Court of Appeals, the White case, in fact is a case that holds that no expert testimony was required in the case. It involved the handling of a farm animal and what should be done. That case did state the law as the state of Wisconsin and the courts have interpreted that only where there is a need for an explanation of complicated information that the jury needs that help to come to their ultimate decision does an expert have to be presented. I would like to address several matters in this respect. The jury instructions that are presented once a trial is ended embody what I think is the correct application of the law in circumstances such as this. For example, in a medical malpractice case where the question of a degree of care and the type of care that was presented or provided, that jury instruction does require an expert opinion. However, on the medical malpractice matter of informed consent, there is no such requirement of an expert witness to testify because the standard is one of reasonableness. We submit that the standard of reasonableness is one which a lay individual, such as a jury, a member of a jury, is that kind of person that can take all the factors that are presented to them and determine whether or not the actions or activities were reasonable that they have to determine.
Mr. Ramphan, do you think that the Court of Appeals was influenced here by the fact that the state had an expert witness? In other words, was the ultimate conclusion by the Court of Appeals that you should have had an expert witness because of the fact the state had an expert witness?
I do believe that's the fact. And in fact, it was the City of West Allis, yes. As opposed to the, that is a minor correction, but I do believe that the Court of Appeals ruling is that there was an expert opinion. Because we did not have one, we lost our right to present an excessive force case. Had they considered that affidavit and the foundation for that affidavit in the context of summary judgment methodology, we would be talking about something differently. But what they did is they said, plaintiff, you do not have an expert. You cannot present an excessive force case. It is our position that in cases involving this constitutional right, that you do not necessarily need an expert to provide an opinion to assist the jurors in determining whether or not excessive force indeed occurred. Again, I refer the justices to the reasonableness standard, which is not an expert standard, which is not a standard that the jury needs to hear an expert.
Well, in this particular situation where the city was presenting an expert witness, was that expert witness getting into some detail as to normal and usual police practice?
My reading of the Assistant Chief Police Amapol's affidavit is that what he did is took the version of the accident, of the incident, as testified to or presented by the police officers, and said this version, under what we believe to be appropriate uses of force, was satisfactory.
His affidavit is at Appendix 139 of your brief, right? So we can all look at it.
What I believe is that this appendix, this particular affidavit, first of all, is not based on the personal knowledge of Officer Amapol. It's based on what has been told by him and a specific version of the set of circumstances surrounding this stop, the interaction between Mr. Robinson and the two police officers, and the subsequent actions.
That's always true of expert witness.
I was going to say,
does that all the time.
We're just asking the same question. Isn't that what an expert witness always does? Isn't that what they look at the situation? And are you suggesting, when you say personal experience, what are you talking about?
He was not there. What he's taking.
Well, most expert witnesses are not at the scene of the incident.
And I understand that, so that when you take an expert's opinion, and if you're going to use it in terms of determining an issue of either fact or of law, you have to look at the underlying factual basis for that. If the affidavit of Amapol is to be considered at all, one must look to the underlying factual basis for that. He does not address the factual circumstances as presented by Mr. Robinson. And again, this is in the context of summary judgment. I'm not saying they cannot present an expert opinion in this matter. What I'm saying is that in summary judgment, our claim for excessive force cannot be denied because we do not have a contrary opinion from an expert witness. Is that his position?
It seems to me that you have two issues. One, which you stated, is that you can't go into a case on excessive force without expert witness. Therefore, you have a failure of proof on a summary judgment. It's just nothing. And so you lose.
I believe that's what the Court of Appeals said, and I think that is erroneous in the state of Wisconsin.
So what do you think is erroneous? Now, it seems to me that one of the things you're saying is that it is erroneous to say that a plaintiff in this kind of case needs an expert witness to make the point. Your position, if I understand it, is that you're a plaintiff testified as to facts and did do depositions here, and that that is adequate to get to a jury to raise an issue of fact, and that a jury can decide excessive force without either side giving expert testimony.
Because I do not believe that is a requirement under the law in the state of Wisconsin. I'm not saying you cannot present that information, such as in a motor vehicle accident case, you can hire an expert to reconstruct the accident, but even the jury instruction, the standard jury instruction regarding expert testimony is, if the jury does not believe that the foundation for the expert's opinion is correct, they can disregard that opinion.
But we're at summary judgment, so the issue is whether you had raised enough an issue of material fact to withstand a summary judgment.
Yes, Your Honor. We accept that burden. We believe that other than the fact that we do not have an expert opinion to say there was excessive force, we have raised sufficient issues of material fact that would defeat summary judgment, that if those, if the inference is taken from the facts as testified to by Mr. Robinson in the context of a trial, that we would in fact have an opportunity to be successful.
What are some of the issues of material fact that remain?
I believe that this is a very fluid interaction between a person who's been stopped for an alleged traffic incident. It entails such things as the manner in which he produces and presents the concealed weapon, which he testified that he did in fact have a folding knife in a carrying case under his jacket. How he presented that is in dispute because it is the manner in which he presents it that would give the police officers the information that they would then have to determine what would they have to do to respond to that potential threat. The police officer said he did it in a certain way. Mr. Robinson said, I simply put it out in my hand and was holding it there and tried to hand it to my girlfriend. That is an issue of fact. Another issue of fact is at what time was he under control? Mr. Robinson's testimony is that once he was down on the ground and had arms behind his back, that he was lifted. First of all, his head was slammed into the ground. He was already on the ground. Then he was lifted, carried over to the curb, and then dropped from about waist high. The police officers deny this, saying that he was struggling during this time period and that anything that occurred to him by their use of force was in response to his continuing struggle and their observations and their interpretation that he was a threat to them. These are several of the issues which I believe are central to the case, where there's a diametrically opposed version by Mr. Robinson and by the police officers.
Counsel, if we might, let's go back to the expert witness issue for a minute. I've got in front of me, and I know that you've read carefully, the captain's affidavit. Now, in his affidavit, he's talking about the force option continuum of the Department of Justice manual, and he's discussing the application of that continuum under these circumstances. Is that the type of thing that you think a layperson would be able to know and understand and apply?
I believe that this force continuum is not a bright line, right or wrong guideline. It is a fluid, ongoing thing that the police officer is entitled to respond to his or her interpretations of a danger to them. I do not believe that when you take that kind of concept and you have to determine whether or not the police officer's response was reasonable, that you need an expert for that. We are not contesting in any way. In fact, one of the initial claims was that the City of West Dallas did not provide appropriate training and appropriate information to the police officers so that they understood this. That would require an expert. Was the training appropriate? However, when you talk about the application of a general guideline as to what somebody could do in the field, it's the reasonableness of the response that is at question. And I think that reasonableness is within the ability of a layperson to determine.
You think that then in a case with like Rodney King with a videotape, you don't think an expert witness was needed for the jury to reach a conclusion one way or another?
I would say absolutely not.
So as a matter of law, you don't think it's needed, although you might recognize in some cases that an expert witness might be needed.
I do not think that an excessive force, when we're talking about the determination of the reasonableness of a police officer's reaction to something, that you absolutely need an expert. Could it be brought in?
Help? Okay.
Yes.
Counsel,
In some ways, I liken your argument to an ordinary negligence case, let's say, auto accident or something like that. If you were at summary judgment, you pled ordinary negligence, and you're a plaintiff, and the defense comes in and brings a motion for summary judgment against your claim and has an affidavit, perhaps, of a reconstruction expert on the issue of negligence, and you don't offer any affidavit in response to the expert reconstruction testimony or affidavit, is that a basis for granting summary judgment against you?
It could very well be in that circumstance, but you have to, whether it be the Circuit Court, Court of Appeals, or the Supreme Court, would have to determine, is the summary judgment appropriate? You weigh the evidence, and you determine whether or not the plaintiff, in this case, if I represented the injured person, if the information that was given by that plaintiff was direct enough and compelling enough, say, for example, no, I was making a right turn at 20 miles an hour, and the reconstruction expert says, no, he was going 50 miles an hour and slammed on his brakes and spun. That would raise an issue of fact. If the plaintiff or the injured person says, well, I don't know what happened, I can't remember, then it could be.
This is in the context of an excessive force claim. What is your legal authority that you cite for the proposition that determination of excessive force is within the province of the jury, that a jury can but need not have the benefit of an expert witness? What legal authority do you cite for that?
I believe that it is both the interpretation of the previous case law, at what points is expert testimony needed to assist the layperson. I rely on the jury instructions which are given to the individual jurors at the end of the case.
Okay, let's take a look at the jury instruction, if you can get that in front of you. I assume that you're talking about 2155 Federal Civil Rights, excessive force and arrest.
Thank you.
That's in somebody's appendix, too.
Mm-hmm.
What part of the jury instruction or the jury instruction notes are you relying on for the proposition that it's normally within the province of a reasonable person to determine if there was excessive force?
What we believe is that the burden is upon the plaintiff to satisfy he, meaning the jury, I'm talking about about the sixth paragraph, by clear, satisfactory, and convincing evidence that the force used in arresting him or her was excessive and more than was reasonable under the circumstances then and there existing. I believe that the use of the term reasonable puts it within the context of the layperson. And in fact, there is the case which is cited on page 7 of our initial brief, the Johnson versus Ray case, 99 Wisconsin 2nd, 777.
And in that case, do you have that case before you?
I have this other citation from it.
Are you referring to that part of the case that cites the 5 Amateur second arrest?
I'm not sure if that's the section. I'm not sure if I brought the whole case with me, Your Honor. But the portion that we have cited in our brief is that the test for reasonableness is that which an ordinarily prudent and intelligent person with knowledge and in the situation of the arresting officer would have deemed necessary under the circumstances.
Yeah, I think that's the quote from 5 Amateur arrests in the Johnson versus Ray case.
And then the court goes on to say, it will be the jury's duty to determine when the excessive force commenced and what injuries it caused. This is no more difficult than our requiring jurors to separate injuries sustained in different accidents and then allowing damages only for the accident being tried. It analogizes it to another circumstance where potentially you can have any kind of evidence you need, but for example, in a successive accident case, it would be, you could have a doctor saying, this accident caused this injury, and this accident caused that injury, but you could also have the individual person saying, for example, a soft tissue injury, I was okay after 2 weeks. So the second accident, a month later, caused all my problems. A doctor's opinion, even saying the second accident caused those injuries, would be based on that layperson's testimony of what accident caused what. And I do not think you'd need an expert doctor to testify which injuries caused what. The layperson would be the ultimate one to say which caused what. And in the context of a trial, a jury, we require the juries to do a lot of hard things. And this is one of them.
You know, but just because the jury decides the issue doesn't mean you don't need expert testimony. For example, in many medical malpractice cases, you do need expert testimony, yet the jury makes the decision. So I'd like to move you on, if I can.
Of course.
Because there have been some... First of all, you have a second issue here about the deliberate refusal of medical care. And you've got the waiver of claim issue, issue preclusion, and qualified immunity defenses.
We've
got 5 minutes.
Okay, thank you. On the deliberate indifference, I believe the Court of Appeals' incorrect statement is that because there was no excessive force, there can be no deliberate indifference. I think that's incorrect. I think that the Court of Appeals also stated that the... you look back and you say, oh, he didn't have a serious injury, therefore there was no deliberate indifference. I think that's incorrect. It's the observations of the police officer at the time and whether or not the person should have received treatment at that time, not a hindsight 20/20 view. On the questions of issue preclusion, I'll try to make it as short as possible. This is one of the most troubling parts of the defense that the defendants have raised, is that because Mr. Robinson pled to several charges. He pled guilty to one, carrying a concealed weapon. No contest to the battery. Three other charges were dropped. What the defendants are trying to do and what the Court of Appeals agreed is that you take the criminal complaint, and because Mr. Robinson said you can use that as a basis for my plea of guilty to the carrying a concealed weapon, and as a basis for my no contest plea on the other one. Because of that, they are now saying anything that's stated in there is fair game, that he cannot contest. I don't think that's the case. In the case of Heck, it's only those factual issues which would negate the charge that he pled to, the charge of guilty. I would even go further to say that the charge of no contest cannot be used against him in a collateral matter. I've cited some cases in this. Therefore, I do not think that issue preclusion is a matter which should be used by this court to prevent Mr. Robinson from explaining what happened and sustaining his claim for excessive force and deliberate indifference. The last one, qualified immunity, by the very nature of its terms, it is immunity, but it's qualified according to the circumstances. It's not carte blanche, it's not diplomatic immunity, it's not blanket immunity. We submit that once excessive force occurs, that qualified immunity ends. I'm not saying the police officers have no qualified immunity. It's one of the foundations of their ability to act as police officers. What I'm saying is that there are circumstances under which that qualified immunity can be eliminated, and that's when excessive force occurs.
What was the injury, if any, to which the officers were deliberately indifferent?
At the time that Mr. Robinson was on the ground, he had complained of the fact that when his statement, again, is that a police officer put his foot on his back, and that Steve Robinson came, I have a kidney problem, any pressure might give me problems. And nothing was ever mentioned after that. The other matter is that he lost consciousness at one point, and the only treatment that he received that was given to him was, in fact, because they had pepper sprayed him at one point and they washed his face.
What further treatment did he get then, sir? I mean, was there something, I think the question Justice Strasburg is asking is, what were his, you explained his difficulties, but did he have further problems?
He actually did not have any further treatment. Nothing occurred to him as a matter of the pressure being put on his black back, but because of the pressure on it, he was concerned and addressed it to the police officer. They didn't respond to it in any way.
Well, if I understand your brief, you take the position that you look at the indifference or deliberate failure to provide care at the moment he's in jail or on his way to jail, and that you don't look after the fact whether or not he had a problem.
I believe that the standard should be that at that time, when it should appear to the police officers that there is some kind of treatment needed, that it should be at least addressed. Whether or not later on he has any problems from that, you can't use it as a justification for not checking it through.
For the moment, I'll accept that. But you're in a lawsuit now, and the bottom line is going to be money damages.
Yes.
So if you have a situation where, let us just say, the jailed person complains while he's being transported to jail. The offender complains he's got a sharp pain on his right side. Take him to the hospital for appendicitis or whatever. And they don't. And here he was jailed for 5 days. And in 5 days, never asks for a doctor, nurse, never complains about his side, and leaves and doesn't have appendicitis. Just fine. So maybe they should have taken him to the hospital, maybe under the circumstances I'm giving you. But it turned out he didn't have anything, or he may have just had a stomach ache. I may have been hypertension at the time. But he's fine. So what kind of damages can you get?
I don't think that is a measure of whether or not a constitutional right was...
Pardon me?
I do not believe that the measure of damages should determine whether or not a constitutional right has been violated.
But then what's your relief under 1983? An injunction from doing it again? What's your relief?
It would be the fact that he did sustain some pain and discomfort upon that time, and whether or not it extended to something that required treatment or whatever. It may be minimal at best, Your Honor, but it is nonetheless a...
Your damage here is anxiety.
And the pain that he experienced during the time period that he did not have any follow-up to determine whether or not, in fact, he had a problem with his kidneys or not, and perhaps some anxiety. I do not deny that element of the damages in this case is not as egregious as sometimes that we find in some of the case law that you've mentioned.
Thank you, counsel. You will have 5 minutes for rebuttal. We have Assistant City Attorney from West Dallas, Scott Post. Mr. Post.
Thank you, Justice Abramson. May it please the court, Mr. Rampton. First, I'd like to comment, Judge, that if the high school students have actually been forced to read these briefs, I think cruel and unusual punishment has been demonstrated here. That would not be fair. I think this oral argument is the strangest that I've encountered, because typically the two sides disagree over the issues, but here I think we're completely disagreeing about what the issues even are. The only one that we agree on is the failure to provide medical attention claim. I think that's an issue that is before this court. The rest of the argument that Mr. Rampton made, I don't think is before this court any longer. Basically, I think there are three issues that need to be addressed. The first is that the petitioners have waived all of their pre-custody excessive force claims. The case now basically goes to the post-restraint conduct.
Why did they waive the pre-custody?
Why did they?
Yes.
How did they? Okay, yeah. Why, I have no idea. How did they? Well, think the argument Mr. Rantham made is the one that he made in circuit court, and that was proper there. But in his Court of Appeals brief, the plaintiff wrote at page 15, quote, that he was only complaining, quote, of conduct arising after he had been restrained and subdued. And the Court of Appeals picked up on that and made that a linchpin of their decision. They said, well, what is all this talk about Captain Amrapool's affidavit, Heck, issue preclusion, and qualified immunity if you are no longer contesting?
What page?
Page 15.
Okay.
Of the Court of Appeals brief filed by the plaintiff. And the Court of Appeals said, if you're not looking at any of that stuff prior to him being handcuffed and in custody, then we don't care what Captain Amrapool had to say or whether issue preclusion applies or any of those other things. So why look at them? Also, in his reply brief...
Here's what he says on page 15. Here, because the plaintiff does not contest the authority of the officers to arrest him and only complains of conduct arising after he had been restrained and subdued, the excessive use of force claim has no effect on the validity of the plaintiff's arrest or in his subsequent confinement. You read that to say he's only complaining after he's in custody?
Right, that's what I do. And the Court of Appeals certainly did. And I think it becomes even clearer in his reply brief to this court. At pages 2 and 3, he writes, quote, thus, the question is not whether respondent officers were acting in their official capacity and had lawful authority to arrest petitioner, but rather did their actions after petitioner had been restrained, subdued, and no longer posed a threat to them rise to the level of excessive force. So
well,
clearly he's talking about after I'm in custody, after I'm handcuffed, that's when I'm now raising my excessive force claims.
But you don't have to read it that way, sir. You can read it that... he was restrained very early on, and wasn't he handcuffed at the time they allegedly lifted him off by his pants and struck him?
The two allegations of force after the handcuffing is that he was picked up by his belt, carried over to the curb and dropped, and a foot was put in his back.
Pardon me?
A foot was put on his back.
Yeah. Okay, so...
And those weren't really ever addressed by the Court of Appeals.
That's right.
All the prior stuff, they said, well, geez, he's waiving all that. He's recognizing that
X won't allow. What was the prior stuff?
The prior? The allegations were scrapes to his forehead when he was taken down to the ground, his thumb being hurt from being twisted behind his back, and his shoulder being injured by being pulled behind his back.
Okay, so we just take those out, and we're dealing with him being slammed on the curb or street with his head. Don't you think? Did he waive that?
No. The allegation that his head was slammed on the curb, I don't think is an allegation that's present. Mr. Robinson testified at deposition that that never occurred.
Counsel, I'm looking at the complaint that's been filed in this. And I'm looking to a verbiage 9, which says, after Robinson voluntarily pulled over, Ball parked the police vehicle behind Robinson's motorcycle, got out of the police vehicle, and approached Robinson. Paragraph 10, that is the following paragraph of the 9, I interpret as averring the beginning of the cause of action. It reads as follows. Defendant Ball then, without explaining what, if anything, Robinson had done wrong, violently threw Robinson onto the hood of the police vehicle. Isn't that paragraph 9 where the claim begins, and at the point in time when the defendant is alleging the cause of action arises.
Paragraph 12, after dragging plaintiff onto the sidewalk, defendant slammed his head against the cement, forcibly pinned him on the ground, and then 13 says after he was handcuffed. So 12 may not be clear as to whether it's pre or post, but if it's a liberal interpretation, it could be pre.
I showed in the briefs through citing to Mr. Robinson's brief that the allegation of hitting his head on the ground occurred prior to being handcuffed, and so that was cleared up. And so I think that all these questions of you know, whether the criminal complaint precludes him from changing his story, whether issue preclusion does, the jury instructions and the Heck case preclude him from changing his story, don't really apply to any of this post-custody thing, conduct, because he has said that, and I think it's a recognition that he can't really defeat the effect of Heck, that the lawful authority of the police officers that was established by the resisting an officer plea has to be contradicted by the plaintiff in this case, and Heck doesn't allow that. And that's why I think he made the statement first in the Court of Appeals and again in this court that he was no longer looking to that conduct before he was in custody.
Well, when was he in custody? Was he in custody according to the allegation? I'm not talking, you know, we're here early in summary judgment, so I don't know what's true or not true. But would he be in custody legally, in your opinion, if he were violently thrown on the hood of the police vehicle?
No, because certainly the way the plaintiff makes it, he says post-restraint. He talks about pre-restraint claims. And so to me, that means before he's handcuffed, because you're not restrained until you're in handcuffs. That would be my interpretation of it.
Could I ask, there's an allegation that one of the officers, when the gentleman was down, put his foot on the back of Mr. Robinson, and somewhere there's boot impressions in the back or something. Is that after he's in custody or
yes,
before?
That's after.
That's after he's in custody.
Correct.
Could that be considered excessive force?
Certainly. The problem that I have with it is he never alleges that in his complaint, and he never alleges any Eighth Amendment cruel and unusual custody allegation in his complaint. So neither factually nor legally does he make allegations making us aware of this. The first time we became aware that he was pursuing that claim was in his Court of Appeals brief. That's the first time that that allegation or that issue really came to the forefront. And certainly his version of the facts there are not precluded by anything in the criminal complaint, because that only went up to the point of when he was in custody.
I'm having difficulty, and I'm sorry for interrupting, but when you say he never knew it was part of the claim, I look at paragraph 12 about the boots, and it says, after dragging plaintiff onto the sidewalk, defendants, the two officers, slammed his head against the cement and forcibly pinned him to the ground by sticking their boots into his back. Seems to me that's part of the claim. Paragraph 12.
Okay, yeah, I see that. But and I don't doubt that that is an excessive force claim that can be made. The problem with it is the plaintiff has never addressed qualified immunity in relation to that boot on the back. I cited to cases with similar fact basis where the defendant has to show that where he's in custody that it's cruel and unusual punishment and that no reasonable police officer would do that. And the cases are remarkably similar in that in the case that I cited, the person is in custody and is then being held down, just like Mr. Robinson is. And the court ruled that you have to then show that no reasonable police officer would both respond to a crowd by holding the suspect down after you struggled with them and then face the crowd. That's what the officers did here, by Mr. Robinson's allegations, although the officers, you know, of course, denied them, but we have to take them as true, that he held him down with a boot on his back and then faced the crowd that Mr. Robinson said was there and getting angry. That's what any reasonable officer would do, and Mr. Robinson hasn't offered anything to defeat that qualified immunity. Under Mr. Rampton's analysis, there would never be qualified immunity. Every excessive force case would always go to the jury because he says it's a factual issue. Well, if that's the case, then what does Estelle versus Gamble, the Estate of Phillips case, what are they all about? They're summary judgment declarations by the Supreme Court and by a Court of Appeals that based on these facts that we have, we're ruling as a matter of law that you haven't defeated the qualified immunity claim. Qualified immunity comes in and requires the plaintiff to show that the conduct was unreasonable or illegal at the time. And that hasn't been done here.
Well, that is a basic problem on cases that deal with qualified immunity where you've got factual issues and whether you can get to a jury. And I don't see why where you, well, You agree that excessive force is a factual issue for the jury?
Yes, and absent qualified immunity, that would be a jury question. An expert testimony would help, but wouldn't be necessary.
Now, then, if the person doesn't have qualified immunity, does it go to the jury, excessive force?
Right, unless there's some other reason, right, if that was your only issue. But there's sort of an interplay between qualified immunity and excessive force because it creates a benchmark that the plaintiff has to get to before it gets to a jury.
And what is that benchmark? How can I tell in a case whether it goes over the benchmark for qualified immunity?
Well, in the excessive force arena, the plaintiff has to show that the officer acted contrary to the law and that no officer would be using force in the manner that it was used. And as I've cited to the cases here, the Wallace case, the struggle that occurred here is similar to the struggle in Wallace. Trying to gain control of somebody, taking them to the ground, them receiving injuries, is what officers are trained to do, as what Captain Amrapool's affidavit said they were trained to do. And he hasn't shown anything that would indicate that what the officers did would be improper along those lines.
Well, let's just accept his complaint for the moment. His complaint is that it can be read this way, after he's been restrained, he has been lifted by his pants and his head smashed, and that a foot has been placed on his back. Now, this is post-custody. That's the allegation. Now, why would you think that as a matter of law, no officer, or that every officer would do that?
I agree with you that if the allegation were true, that his head was smashed, that would be, no officer would ever reasonably do that.
And
but the problem with that is,
would an officer reasonably put his foot on his back after he's restrained?
I think so. You've just had a long struggle with somebody who produced a knife. He's been very combative, and now there's a crowd that you have to face, and to still maintain control on that person, you put your foot on their back to face that crowd. I certainly think that would be reasonable. But with regard to the head smashing allegation, Mr. Robinson's deposition makes it clear that did not occur after he was handcuffed. And so I don't think that's part of this case, even though it's in his allegations. A number of his allegations are admittedly false by his own testimony. But the two issues that he does bring, that a foot was put in his back and he was carried by his belt, he hasn't brought forth two things. One, that it would be unreasonable for an officer to do that. And number two, that he received any injury other than a bruise on his back. And that sort of gets us to the medical attention claim.
Well, can he claim excessive force? Let's get away from qualified immunity, even though he doesn't show extreme or serious injury.
The general rule is that no injury or de minimis injury isn't enough for excessive force. And I've cited the Burr and I'm not sure how you say it, Namachi versus Rule case for that proposition. A slight injury, a bruising in the Burr case because of the handcuffs being applied, was disregarded by the court, saying there has to be more than just this de minimis injury for excessive force, because an officer in making arrest is by definition applying force, and what the claim is for excessive force, and if all you have is some bruising, that doesn't rise to the level of that. And then the second part of it with regard to the medical attention claim, again, he hasn't presented any evidence that he needed medical attention. What he has here basically is he's saying that if somebody tells a police officer of a condition that they have, that officer then has a duty to take them to the hospital. Well, it doesn't work in the real world, number one. People tell police officers things all the time. As they're being handcuffed, they'll mention that they have a carpal tunnel, or that their shoulder's injured so they don't be handcuffed behind their back, or that they have a neck or a back injury so that they're eased into the squad car, or that they have some medication that they're taking, I'm diabetic or whatever, so that when they're in jail, they'll be receiving their medication. That doesn't mean we have to run them to the hospital every time they mention that they have a condition. What they have to do is they have to provide attention to serious medical needs. and I've cited both the federal and state cases that hold that. And the fact of the matter is that Mr. Robinson had no serious medical needs. By his own testimony and the admission of counsel here again today, all he needed was his eyes to be flushed out from the pepper spray. That was done. And I think what's most important in this case is the fact that the officers, upon getting control of Mr. Robinson, called for paramedics to treat Mr. Robinson. They came, they treated him, they flushed his eyes out. He makes no further complaints to them. He's in custody in the Milwaukee County House of Correction for several days, makes no request for medical attention, and after he's released, seeks no medical attention. No medical attention was required. So what medical attention did we fail to provide to him?
Didn't
he hasn't met his burden at all on that.
Did his mother call, say, my son needs medical attention?
No.
What'd she say?
I'm trying to recall Mr. Robinson's deposition. He basically said that, yeah, she called to find out, but obviously she wouldn't know what my condition was at the time because I'd never seen or spoken to her. So she didn't call to say he had this condition or was suffering from it.
So she didn't call anybody in the police department?
I don't know if she called or not, but according to Mr. Robinson, if she made a call, her call would have been to advise us of a condition, not that he was actually suffering from something at that point. Because by his own admission, he wasn't at that point.
Is the knowledge of anyone in the police department attributed to everybody in the jail?
I would think so, yes.
Okay.
Counsel, I just want to make sure on this expert witness question that occupied a bit of the discussion in the preceding argument of your opposing counsel, and also occupied a bit of the first portion of his brief. I understood your comment in response to the chief to be that you agree that excessive force is a jury question, and it's nice but not necessary to have expert testimony on excessive force.
Assuming you've overcome the qualified immunity hurdle, right? Once you get past that, then it's a case of. Yep. This is what happened. Do you, members of the jury, think that was excessive under the circumstances? That's the rule. To get there, you have to get over qualified immunity.
And absent qualified, I mean, in your brief, I know you argue in part that issue is waived and it's moot, but absent waiver, absent mootness, absent qualified immunity, for the general premise or proposition that you need an expert witness in order to maintain a cause of action for unreasonable use of force, your answer is no.
Rule, correct, right. I think that's clearly the law in virtually every federal jurisdiction, that when you simply have the question of was it excessive force, that's a jury question or a fact-finding question. The other thing that I wanted to mention with regard to the medical claim was that I think it's clear that the Court of Appeals did not rule that if there was reasonable force used, the officer can let the person just bleed to death. That's not what the Court of Appeals held at all, and I think plaintiff recognizes that when they then go into the argument regarding what is required for providing medical attention. The reason why I'm puzzled about plaintiff's argument regarding the excessive force is the Heck case and the conviction on the resisting an officer. If he admits in the criminal complaint that the officers were using lawful authority, he can no longer, under the jury instructions for excessive force, meet his burden of proof that the officers exceeded their lawful authority. The two just don't
jive.
Where
did he admit that they used lawful force? He admitted that, didn't contest, let us say that the arrest was unlawful because he was arrested, originally picked up for speeding?
Several traffic violations,
okay.
Right.
Okay. And then he agrees that he was carrying a concealed weapon, so the arrest would have been for probable cause when they saw the weapon. But even if I concede that, why would, and even if I conceded that I, and I didn't concede, I had a no contest to battery, why would I necessarily concede that that the force used was excessive? I'm just, why would I do that?
Well,
I mean, why did he do that here?
I don't know that he needed to. He certainly contested it in the circuit court, but in the Court of Appeals, he backed away from that and solely focused on the post-custody conduct.
Yeah, okay, that's what I'm trying to get.
Not the struggling with the officers before he was handcuffed.
So it's not issue preclusion because of his pleas. Is that what you're arguing?
Right, that's what I'm saying. Because okay. That's sort of gone now regarding that pre-custody, pre-handcuffing.
You're arguing that he waived it because of an admission in a brief? Is that what you're arguing?
Right. Well, basically a concession in his brief that he was no longer focusing on that struggle that he had with the officers and the injuries that he received there.
Post, pre, everything. Is that what you're arguing?
Pre-custody. Now, after custody, that's a different circumstance altogether. There, I think...
So he still has a case on post-custody?
He may still... He certainly hasn't waived that case on post-custody. He's made arguments on it. But what he has to do on those claims is, again, defeat the qualified immunity that the officers have raised and make some demonstration that the conduct alleged was unlawful at the time and the officers should have known it. And he hasn't done anything to, either bring forward case law or an affidavit saying that placing your foot on somebody's back while you're dealing with a crowd is an excessive use of force. And that's what qualified immunity requires.
Your position is that that officers know that use of excessive force is not permitted. And officers know that use of excessive force might be a violation of a constitutional right, right?
Correct.
But that the plaintiff here had to prove more, had to assert more than that, and that here the plaintiff had to show that an officer would know that putting a person's, putting his or her foot in the back is excessive force.
Correct.
And would have to also know that slamming the head is excessive force. But there you say there's a conflict with the deposition. Okay.
Yeah.
So unless the officer knows that putting the foot on the back is excessive force, you never get to trial.
Correct. Because the standard in the custody situation, the cruel and unusual punishment, is wanton infliction of pain. It's a different standard when you get to the Eighth Amendment claim. And again, that requires a demonstration by the plaintiff that that's so. But the case law that I've cited to indicates that that type of conduct has been approved by the courts. So what I'm arguing is that how would the officers know that that conduct is illegal if courts have approved that very type of conduct when you're dealing with a crowd and you've got a handcuffed but just recently subdued combative subject?
You're not claiming that issue preclusion bars the defendant's claim by relying on the no contest plea for battery to a police officer. You're not...
For post-custody conduct of the officers. That's correct. Because the criminal case only concerned the fight among the officers and Mr. Robinson before he was handcuffed.
In reading and thinking about this, I mean, my sense was the elements of the offense of battery to a police officer for which the defendant pled no contest, really those elements don't involve an inquiry into excessive force, do they?
For the elements of battery itself, do they implicate on the elements of the excessive force jury instructions? No, not directly. I think it's the resisting an officer one.
Yeah,
that's
the
resisting an officer charge is the one that really impacts upon his ability to state a claim for that pre-custody struggle and any injuries he received there. Because in admitting to the resisting an officer, he admits to allegations which are diametrically opposed to the
allegations. Is that one of the lead-in offenses?
Correct.
Yeah, so he pled no contest to battery to a law officer. And there are three or four elements to that offense. None of those elements implicate an inquiry into excessive force.
No, the only impact they really have on the case is the excessive force picture is the totality of the circumstances. And in some of the cases I've cited, the woman at the side of the road in Wallace, who two police officers take to the ground, who's not armed, Phillips, who's armed with pens in his case. Here we have a subject who's got a knife and who batters an officer during the struggle. That gives an indication about what type of struggle was going on and what force would be necessary under the circumstances, and goes toward Captain Amrapool's affidavit that under those circumstances the force used was reasonable during the struggle, not post-custody. Captain Amrapool's affidavit addresses nothing post-custody at all.
Can I ask a question here? This alleged action of being grabbed by the back of the pants, using the belt, being dragged to the street and dropped 2 to 3 feet. It's kind of a dramatic picture that one is painted. Did that incident actually happen?
I don't know. The officers say it didn't. Mr. Robinson says it did. So for purposes of this, we would say that it did. And then the question is that excessive use of force? He claims no injury out of that, being carried like that. And it's my position that absent injury, again, under the Burr and Nemanji case, there's no excessive use of force. Simply being carried by your belt like that and not receiving injury without any type of injury cannot be excessive use of force as a matter of law.
Does that require expert testimony to evaluate that?
I don't think so. It's strictly a case of the law requires that there be at least some injury in some courts and in others beyond a nominal injury. And here we have absolutely no injury. So he hasn't even stated a claim with regard to that. Basically, force was applied without injury. It can't be excessive.
Counsel? I don't want to equate this to Rodney King, because we don't know what the facts of this case really are. But let me use that as a hypothetical. If, and I have in mind a videotape that probably most of us saw on TV regarding that arrest, if that what many of us saw on the videotape was the whole picture, and I have no idea if it really was, but if that was what happened in totality, and if Rodney King only sustained a bruise, or I think the plaintiff here is asserting a bruise on the back from the footprint, but no serious permanent injuries. Are you suggesting that cannot be denominated excessive force?
Well, that's an almost impossible question to answer. Obviously, when you're being hit by batons and you get several skull fractures and other injuries, that you're not going to be whacked by batons and not receive injury. So I can't really answer that. That simply wouldn't happen. But I think what you have in the Rodney King-type situation...
Well, it could be that you could be whacked by batons and not sustain a permanent injury. That's plausible.
What would occur in the Rodney, and what did occur in the Rodney King case, is that the application of the baton, and there was expert testimony in it, was improper in that for a variety of reasons. Number one, he was down on the ground. Number two, the strikes were to vital areas as opposed to the arms or legs, as the officers are instructed. And in the force continuum, that instruction is there. It required expert testimony in that case to put that before the jury.
What's the definition of serious injury? What's your definition of serious injury?
Something more than a bruise, I would say, doesn't require treatment.
You need more of a bright line than that, don't you? I mean, something more of a bruise and an ache, you know, like what do you...
Well, you know, that's the Burr case, is a bruise, and the court there said that's not enough. And I don't think you can draw a bright line, as the courts typically do. They may tell you what's not good enough to state a claim, but they never tell you what is going to be a claim. And I don't think I can really do that here either as to what the injury was. But I think it needs to be something more than a bruise, and the case law makes that clear. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Post. Mr. Ramson?
Thank you very much for allowing me some additional time. I appreciate it, Your Justices. First issue I'd like to respond to is this whole question of Mr. Robinson's injuries. We've had a lot of statements from opposing counsel here as to what occurred when. There's no proof before the court as to that. Mr. Robinson did indeed suffer serious injury to one of his shoulders. No testimony has been presented nor given at this point in the stage of the proceedings as to that injury and when it occurred. Mr. Post has provided us with information that any injury had to have occurred post-custody, which is an issue that I'm going to address later. So therefore, I don't think this court can use the minimal information in front of it as to the extent of Mr. Robinson's injuries to make any of its rulings. Secondly, I'd like to address the fact that Mr. Post indicated that Mr. Robinson admitted that he was resisting officers. That was a read-in charge in the context of his plea to the carrying concealed weapon, the guilty plea, the no-contest plea to the battery. In addition to the resisting, a disorderly conduct charge was dismissed. An OAR from that incident was dismissed. An OAR from an unrelated incident was dismissed. I do not think the court can take the fact that he was charged and then a resisting charge dismissed and use it, as the Court of Appeals did, to find that no excessive force occurred as a matter of law. I'd like to address the question of... I'm sorry.
Could you please directly address the immunity, qualified immunity issue?
Okay, I will do that. The case law, as far as I know it, is that under qualified immunity, it exists. If you can find a matter that is similar to the circumstances of your case, that is good. But sometimes actions can shock or to impress a trier of fact that qualified immunity no longer exists. The lifting of him by the belt and dropping from 3 feet, I don't think we need a case similar to that, but I direct the court to page 12 of our reply brief, where we have listed a number of cases where an excessive use of force was allowed, and it had to do with matters of, for example, in Lewis and Downs, referring to on page 12, went to the jury, and because officers had kicked the plaintiff while the plaintiff lay handcuffed on the ground. Very similar. We have the number of other cases, the Thomas case, upholding a verdict of excessive force against a prison guard who punched an inmate in the mouth after the plaintiff had been restrained, even though there was an active resistance. We believe that in this case, there's not enough information for a determination of qualified immunity to occur. It's indicated throughout the whole briefs, there's not enough information as to what went on at what time. And indeed, there's one case cited by the defendants, which is the Wallace case, the Northern District of Ohio, where there's a leg sweep. Well, in that case, What happened is, as the officer was doing it, the officer slipped, and that's what caused the injuries. For example, if Mr. Robinson had been Winter, and the police officer was assisting Mr. Robinson up after his handcuff, and they slipped and fell, that would not be excessive force. But that's not what occurred here. It would be a police officer acting within the scope of his authority and without using excessive force, and injuries unfortunately occurred during the context of it. They put him in the squad. They get in an accident. They get rear-ended. These are all injuries which can occur where qualified immunity would apply.
I'm having real trouble. If excessive force is a jury question, what hurdle do you have to get over before you, on qualified immunity, before you get to take that to the jury? Because Mr. Post is arguing if everything has to go to the jury, then there isn't that much qualified immunity left.
No.
It's wiped out.
In fact, qualified immunity is not a jury question. But what we're saying here, in the context of this case, there is not enough information to determine whether or not qualified immunity did exist at the time under the circumstances of this interaction between Mr. Robinson and the police officers. That would be something that could be determined. I'm relating this back to this as a summary judgment denial. I'm not saying qualified immunity cannot occur under many circumstances. I do, however, believe that when excessive force occurs, qualified immunity ends.
Yeah.
And that's the reasonableness of the reaction.
What are you, let's just clarify this, are you alleging here pre-custody excessive force?
I am
post-custody excessive force, or both?
I am not sure exactly what is meant by custody. What we are saying is that at some point during this interaction, Mr. Robinson no longer had a weapon, was no longer doing anything which posed any risk to the police officers. At that point, he, according to his testimony, was not only had his head slammed into the ground, but had his arms behind his back, he was lifted and carried and dropped. And then at some point in there, had a foot placed on his back. That's what we're claiming, Your Honor.
Okay.
I don't know if that's custody or not.
What about Mr. Post's assertion that in deposition there was no longer a statement about the foot in the back, if I understood this?
As we all know, depositions are statements taken under oath by somebody who formulates questions to their benefit, and if they can get answers to their benefit, it stands as possible, as it is. If the question was not presented in a way that an appropriate response would be, the foot was in my back, then it would not show up in a deposition. That's the danger of deciding cases on summary judgment.
Well, is that what happened, counsel?
From my understanding, my client does say, in fact, he had a foot in his back at some point when he's on the ground.
That's in your complaint. What about at the deposition? Was a foot ever mentioned?
I don't recall, Your Honor, but I don't think so. But, again, it would be in the context of reading, I don't know.
Yeah, it's on page 153. I was referring to the
Okay. Sorry.
Okay.
All right. Okay.
No, I was just going to say, you're in the deposition, and your client did say that he didn't really need any medical attention anymore. Your client said that on page 160. I was just reading the deposition. So we're talking about the foot in the back and the head slamming, and you were mentioning the serious injury that he suffered. When you got up, you mentioned your opening, you said the injuries, that he had a serious injury to his shoulder.
Yes, Your Honor. And but that was an injury that became more known to him later, beyond the excitement and the enthusiasm of a stop like this, and what was to him a very violent act.
Well, his deposition was on the February 2nd, 98. when he, so he was referring to his injuries at the time he left the jail, is that what?
I believe, and again, I'd have to read through the context of the previous questions and when it came up, Your Honor. I could do that if you want me to, but limit the time.
Thank you, Mr. Ramsey. That concludes our hearing on 9812.